coming to terms.
What is it, Mom?
You are not special enough to overcome a bad marriage.
Your mother boycotted your wedding. She hates your husband, and she only holds you in medium esteem.
How is your life going to get better if you keep having children with that man?
Wait over by the car, honey.
No, come on.
Wait over by the car, honey.
But I want...
Wait over by the car, honey. Now! Now! Now!
Nice boys. You're great with them, too.
I don't really think he wants to have anything more to do with me.
Is it because you wouldn't go to bed with him?
On a first date, Emma.
It's hardly a first date, Mother. I mean, you've been living 10 feet away from him for 15 years. Why don't you talk about the real reason?
I don't know what you mean.
Because it's been about that long since you've done it.
Have you heard anything?
No. And Emma hasn't called you either,
No. Let me know if you hear. And if you talk to Emma, don't sound as frightened as you do.
I don't sound frightened.
This is Garrett.
The one.
Pleasure to meet you.
I've heard so much about you.
Yes, well, your mother's really been looking forward to this, too.
I'll be over later.
The best picture of the 56th Academy Awards, Terms of Endearment, audio described and based on the book by Larry McMurtry. Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 52 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from the April issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine by Hunter Hawk. In this issue of CNI, we look ahead to the experiences that the peaking springtime sun permits. We'll emerge from our caves, as beautifully decorated and full of creature comforts as they might be, and turn our attentions to bolder fashion, to more adventurous travel, to nature's unending opportunities, and to the greater world outside of our bubbles. Some of us will sign up for days and nights of outdoor pursuits at one of the West's many glorious guest ranches. In this issue, we explore how new generations of dude ranchers are tending to their lands and livelihoods. Others will take the driver's seat in epic travel adventures, gathering maps, gear, and itinerary ideas that really rev up a road trip. There's a tantalizing taste of all that in our art director's personal scrapbook of a recent journey in the West. The more fashionable among us will see a new season as a chance to update the styles that signal our inner moods and personalities. You ought to know by now that CNI can help with that, cause you'll find another on-point fashion spread in our special spring and road trip themed feature. Those who stick closer to home base can still find a world of inspiration and sustenance by tending to a garden or a beautiful landscape design. Cultivating outdoor spaces has been a growing trend during the pandemic, and for good reason. An outside oasis, big or small, can feed both your spirit and your stomach. Check out some gardening and landscaping resources in the Home and Ranch section. Even if your weather's not welcoming quite yet, you can still escape to unlimited locales and states of mind via books, visual art, music, and movies. The latest to transport me is the beautifully produced indie film The World to Come, starring Casey Affleck. If you've paid attention to Affleck's body of acting work, you know he's especially attuned to communicating complicated layers of emotion and pain. Makes sense that he's already won an Oscar. His latest effort, and the subject of our cover story, concerns the inner struggles of two couples living through the harsh realities of the 19th century American frontier. The note-perfect performances stayed with me long after the closing credits, and I was thanking my lucky stars that I enjoy the comforts and privileges of modern times. We like to think of CNI as a whole-soul travel guide, and of the April issue as a celebration of warmer weather and all the promise spring brings. As you flip through, we hope you'll be inspired by the people, places, and pursuits that make the American West so special, and this magazine such a pleasure to purchase. Here are two Western storefronts. 4-6's Ranch. Cowboy life in the wide open Wild West doesn't seem such a bygone era when you visit 4-6's Ranch and Supply House in rural Guthrie, Texas. The acclaimed 4-6's Ranch, established in 1870, opened its supply house in 1900 to offer ranch workers the only place where they could get provisions. The mercantile still provides that service to the community today, offering groceries and fuel. And the draw of cowboy culture has made Supply House a nostalgic and historic stop for many tourists hoping to get a taste of ranch life, maybe the chance to strike up a conversation with a real ranch-working cowboy or cowgirl. If you are familiar with the ranch, I think it's just one of those must-do things when you go through that area, says Brandy Blodgett Mustian, the 4-6's Ranch's branded product manager. Sentiments of the old-fashioned general store are still as alive as they were in 1900, like the old cash register and some of the store's original fixtures on display. Cowboy hats of past 4-6's workers even adorn the walls. For those wanting to take a piece of the ranch home with them, the store offers 4-6's originals, collections such as the charcuterie boards milled from the ranch's own wood, boots designed by the ranch's cowboys and cowgirls through a collaboration with Finoglio Boots, and products handcrafted by Texas craftsmen, many of them 4-6's ranch workers who are also skilled artisans. The other Western storefront is Nuevo Rancho. Days on the ranch mean a lot of time on your feet. Your boots should help rather than hinder your rising step count. That's the sentiment that prompted Coco Gonzalez, owner and creative director of Nuevo Rancho, to shift her high fashion focus from studying fashion design in college to something that hit closer to home. We come from West Texas, Gonzalez says. My family and I would wear boots all the time, and our feet would hurt after wearing those $400 to $500 boots. Nuevo Rancho, meaning new ranch, was conceptualized as a new alternative on the Western footwear scene, offering more affordable boots that won't sit unused in a closet due to lack of comfort. Our company is actually a Christian-based business. Every boot is stamped with Jeremiah 29:11, Gonzalez says. We're honest people. We do honest pricing. The brand gained popularity through pop-up shops and as a vendor on the rodeo circuit before getting its own storefront in the historic Fort Worth Stockyards. Store employees aim to treat customers like family, all while sharing product knowledge and helping shoppers create a winning look. We're trying to make customers feel comfortable, says co-owner Teresa Morales. We're not pressuring them. While already complementing its boots with clothing and accessories from other vendors, Nuevo Rancho is quickly expanding its own designs to include hats and clothing. You might come into this store as a customer, but you're sure to walk out materials. Add time-honored tradition to a new house outside Jackson, Wyoming. For a Chicago-area couple who are active hikers, fly fishers, and skiers, their vacation home on the outskirts of Jackson, Wyoming was a fine place to visit. but when they decided to make the mountain town their new home base after they retired, they realized they needed a house that was designed just for them, a place where they could actually live instead of just pop in for summers and holidays. "We needed it to be larger than our previous house," says the wife, "but wanted all the spaces to be sized so they were comfortable and livable." To make their dream house a reality, the couple enlisted Paul Bertelli and Jake Scott of JLF Architects, then hired Talo Pigott and John Thorkildsen to handle the interior design. The result is a 6,500-square-foot alpine abode that's simultaneously rustic and refined. Throughout the custom-built house, plush furnishings and soft tones counterbalance the reclaimed wood and rough stone in the architecture. Creating an ideal mix was also key in the floor plan, which offers plenty of private space for the homeowners, as well as abundant gathering areas for visiting friends and family. For the exterior of the house, the architects chose a classic mix of materials sourced from the surrounding area, including reclaimed snow fence siding and Montana moss rock, both of which they carried over into the interior as well. "We were trying to use a lot of old materials to make it look like this building has been there for ages," says Scott. "Our favorite room is the living room," says the homeowner. "In addition to being a beautiful space with spectacular views of the Tetons, it so easily and comfortably welcomes a crowd. To make the oversized room feel more intimate and to soften the tall timber ceiling and stone walls, Pigott," said Thorkildsen, "created a multiple conversation areas populated with comfy seating upholstered in soft linens and velvets. The lighting was a big part of the living room, too," says Pigott. "The sconces that we put all around the walls give the room a really beautiful ambient light." In the dining room, a custom glass chandelier illuminates an antique grape harvesting table originally from a farmhouse in France. Flanked by mismatched antique chairs and bookended by ruffled velvet benches, the massive table can seat up to 20 people. "It's very rustic, so it fits our no-fuss lifestyle," says the homeowner. "More importantly, it is large enough that no matter the size of our gathering, everyone has a seat at the table." White marble countertops and pickled oak cabinets help brighten up the kitchen, which features reclaimed wood on the ceiling and floor. Montana moss rock on the walls and reclaimed black tiles behind the Wolf Range. The architects used large slabs of sandstone to create an alcove for the cooking station, and the island was designed with hidden storage to make it feel more like a piece of furniture. Keep things cozy in the airy upstairs sitting area, the designers opted for a neutral L-shaped sofa layered with cheerful throw pillows in the homeowner's favorite color. Ruffles are a recurring theme throughout the house, including in the serene owner's suite, where two antique chairs sport new upholstery and ruffled skirts. From the covered porch, the homeowners and their guests can take in views of the nearby pond and the Teton Range in the distance. As with the home's other common spaces, the outdoor room offers plentiful and comfortable seating.
For our next article, I'm going even further back into True West's history. This is from their May-June 1968 archived magazine. We read often about outlaws in the Old West. This particular article that True West published in that 1968 issue is about a pair of notorious criminals from the 20th century. It's Death to Bonnie and Clyde by William C.X. Hancock. Editor's note:
This story has been in our files for 8 years, tagged Run in 1974, which would have been 40 years after the last gun sounded. Back in 1960, when the manuscript was bought, it seemed too recent to print, even if it did portray the biggest manhunt the Southwest has ever seen. The story would still be aging in the files if Bonnie and Clyde hadn't suddenly ridden out of the bog for an early resurrection. Our account will vary somewhat from the movie version, which is why we tore up the tag and are publishing it now. In the last stanza of her final Lad, which laments she compulsively mailed in to the press for the sake of her public, red-haired Bonnie Parker predicted, "Someday we will go down together, and they will bury us side by side. To a few it means grief, but to the law it's relief. But it's death to Bonnie and Clyde." She was crystal-gazing near the end of the Barrow Gang's 2 months terror reign, in which they scourged 9 states, leaving behind a gory trail marked with endless violence, robberies, kidnappings, and 30 corpses. She missed only in that the bullet-riddled body would be interred in the dusty fish trap cemetery in West Dallas, while Clyde Barrow's splintered bones would molder in the wee old French cemetery in the Bog, a West Texas swamp which spawned criminals and mosquitoes with equal facility. But no such morbid thoughts troubled the popular 20-year-old waitress in the winter of 1932 when she teamed with the flashy Clyde Barrow. Just 2 years her senior, Clyde had been paroled from the Texas penitentiary by Governor Ross Sterling. In spite of the fact that less than 2 years of a 14-year sentence had been served, and that he had proved to be a troublesome, unrepentant convict, even deliberately chopping off a big toe to get out of work on the prison farms. Bonnie and Clyde added a third member to their partnership in crime in the person of 18-year-old Raymond Hamilton, destined to become a daring bank robber. Clyde was hardly free of the prison odor before he and Raymond began appearing on Dallas police blotters for burglary and armed robbery. They quickly reached the point of no return when they cold-bloodedly murdered John Butcher, a 61-year-old Hillsboro, Texas garageman, in connection with a stick-up there. A $250 reward was placed on Clyde's head, evidence of the progress up the seamy ladder of crime. The pair cooled out for a spell, then recruited some Confederates in August and lifted the payroll of the Neoff plant in Dallas. A police captain practically stumbled over the gang as they pulled this job. A few minutes later, the robbers roared past the cops in a black V8 Ford sedan, the Barrow trademark, and thumbed their noses as they escaped into Oklahoma. They attended a country dance in Atoka County, where they liquored up and so riotous that Sheriff G.C. Maxwell and Deputy Eugene Moore tried to arrest them. The lawmen were promptly murdered for their efforts, but wounded 2 members of the gang so severely that they were consequently captured. Clyde and Raymond got clear. They proceeded to play hide-and-seek with the police of Oklahoma and North Texas, wrecking or abandoning cars and stealing others as though they were enjoying the game. They even waked up Farmer John Redden late at night near Clayton, Oklahoma, stole his car, and kidnapped his nephew as a hostage. They finally shot their way into Dallas through a police cordon. The two hoodlums borrowed another Ford of the type they favored, picked up Bonnie Parker, and lit out for Carlsbad, New Mexico, where they holed up and proceeded to have a merry time. The setup aroused suspicion, and Deputy Sheriff Joe Johns investigated, finding the gang asleep. He incautiously awakened them, totally unaware of the identities of the dangerous felons with whom he was dealing. The gang disarmed and kidnapped him, and headlines the next day proclaimed that the headless body had been found along the El Paso, Texas highway. This proved a yet unexplained mistake, as that night John walked into the police station in San Antonio to announce that he had been released unharmed outside the city. This bombshell set off an extensive manhunt in the San Antonio area, but the Slippery Barrow Gang merely shifted operations to southeast Texas for a spell. They pulled the auto switcheroo and showered an inquisitive deputy sheriff in Wharton with lead. They veered to West Texas and robbed a supermarket in Abilene. 3 days later, in North Texas, Clyde stuck up a suburban grocery in Sherman. A clerk named Howard Hall was a little slow in handing over the money and received such a brutal pistol whipping that the dazed lad staggered into Barrow, who blasted him to death with 4 shots from his automatic pistol. Clyde whirled to shoot the other clerk, but his gun jammed, so he took to his heels and jumped back into the black V8 Ford with Bonnie at the wheel and raced away in their usual cloud of dust. An additional reward of $200 was placed on Clyde's scalp for this murder. Somewhere along the way, Clyde had become fiercely jealous of Raymond's increasing attentions to Bonnie, and the two outlaws had a bitter falling out. Raymond thereby formed his own bank robbing team, while Clyde and Bonnie, for the next few months, merely beckoned to waiting and willing Confederates in the bog when they required additional firepower for a given job. On November 17, 1933, Texas authorities finally got around to revoking Clyde's parole. Raymond was arrested in Bay City, Michigan in late December and returned to Texas jurisdiction, where he received the whopping prison sentence of 263 years for his exploits, an assessment said to have disappointed him because it was slightly short of a record in penal history for the Southwest. As the prison gates closed around him, he expressed regret for having broken with Barrow. "Clyde won't leave me to rot on no prison farm," he boasted. "When he springs me, we'll team up again and all hell will never catch us." Time would prove him partly correct. Meanwhile, elements of the Barrow Gang celebrated year's end by robbing the bank of Grapevine, Texas. A stool pigeon informed police that gang members would appear in the bog at the home of Hamilton's sister on Saturday night, January 7th. 5 rather inexperienced deputy sheriffs secreted themselves at the address. Somebody in the household placed a red lamp on the living room table, which, unknown to the cops, was a signal to the gang of ambush. A black V8 Ford raced up out of the night and slowed in front of the house, cruising back and forth before halting with motor running. Clyde emerged from the vehicle with a sawed-off 12-gauge automatic shotgun cradled in his arms. He knew cops were in the house, but had developed such paranoid hatred for lawmen that he seemed eager to shoot it out with them at any time. Bonnie crystallized the mania when she stated in one of her ballads that, "There are lots of untruths to our write-ups. We are not so merciless as that. But we hate all the laws, the double-crosser who draws, the stool pigeons, spotters, and rats." Clyde walked up the front porch and blazed away at the deputies, dusting them in general with buckshot, eventually killing investigator Dan covered by rifle fire from the waiting automobile. Clyde ran to it and jumped in, and the vehicle roared away into blackness from which it had come. Sheriffs of Dallas and Tarrant counties offered $400 in additional rewards for the murders. Clyde was now front page stuff, so the heat sent him and Bonnie into hiding in Joplin, Missouri. In late March, 28-year-old brother Buck Barrow got pardoned from the Texas penitentiary by Governor Ma Ferguson. He joined Bonnie and Clyde in Joplin. Police discovered and surrounded the hideout on April 13th, and a bloody battle ensued. Bonnie stood toe-to-toe with her man and sprayed the cops with submachine gun fire. The gang shot their way out of the trap, killing a detective and a constable in the process. The Barrow gang was extremely well-armed, having plundered the National Armory at Ranger, Texas, and stolen a number of BARs, Browning automatic rifles, the high-powered official Army submachine gun, numerous automatic shotguns, a large chamber of .45 caliber automatic pistols with much ammunition. The surplus they cashed with relatives for future inheritance. One could hardly turn around North or East Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, or Louisiana without touching a Parker or Barrow or Hamilton relative. The thing of which people of the bog always had an excess of was kids, and these people were much intermarried. An additional $1,000 reward was offered for Clyde for the Joplin murders, but the gang disdainfully continued its depredations in Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas, then holed up in the swamps of the Black Lake Country in Natchitoches Parish, Louisiana. Funds began to run low by late April, so they moved back into action. Needing a new car for the coming campaign, they drove into Ruston, Louisiana around midday, where Clyde calmly took possession and drove away the vehicle of his choice, while owner H.D. Darby and friend Sophie Stone looked on. The two outraged citizens pursued the thieves in Miss Stone's car, a mistake in judgment as they quickly learned. With characteristic speed demon technique, Clyde outdistanced them, pulled onto a side road, let them pass, then overtook and kidnapped them. Bonnie had joined the party, and the frightened couple was taken along as far as the outskirts of Magnolia, Arkansas. They were well treated and reported that their abductors considered the whole thing a huge joke. The May issue of a National Detective Story magazine added a $100 reward to the price on Clyde's head, an action said by his friends to have tickled his vanity to no end. The gang celebrated this recognition by robbing a bank in Indiana, wounding two women bystanders in the ensuing gun battle with police. The outlaws gaily ducked and dodged the cops of the Midwest, wrecking cars and stealing others until they disappeared into a void in the Southwest. They reappeared on the night of June 11th when Bonnie and Clyde and Buck, while racing down the highway, roaring drunk, catapulted over an embankment some 7 miles north of Wellington, Texas, painfully injuring the Barrows and seriously burning Bonnie with battery acid. Farmer Steve Pritchard witnessed the accident and rushed over to assist the victims. The Barrows covered him with their bars and forced him to carry Bonnie to his house, treat her burns, and put her to bed. Buck went back to the car to see what could be salvaged. A member of the Pritchard household slipped away and telephoned the police. Pritchard's daughter-in-law knocked on the front door, and Clyde fired at the sound, almost shooting the poor girl's hand off. At the sound of the shot, Bonnie awakened and ran out into the front yard, followed by Clyde, after he made the Pritchards extinguish all lights and lie down on the floor. When Sheriff George Corey and Marshal Paul Hardy arrived, the Barrows disarmed and handcuffed them with their own cuffs. The gang shot up the Pritchard car, took the sheriff's car, and kidnapped him and the marshal. They got rid of the cops early the next morning by tying them to trees outside Erick, Oklahoma. Sheriff Corey worked himself free and sounded the alarm. Posses took up the trail, but could not close with the Will of the Wisp Barrow gang. Actually, they holed up in the mountains of northeastern Oklahoma to nurse their hurts. But Bonnie and Clyde failed to respond satisfactorily to their own crude first aid. So they slipped into Vinita, Oklahoma, and took possession of a big house owned by a wealthy woman known to be absent on her Texas ranch. They spirited a registered nurse out of her Miami, Oklahoma, and compelled her to treat them until their recovery was assured. About a week later, the gang was casing the town of Van Buren, Arkansas, when Marshal Henry Humphrey sought to halt them for questioning. the Barrows blasted him out and leapfrogged to the Midwest. They hid out in an isolated tourist court near Platte City, Missouri. Police were tipped to their whereabouts and surrounded the court at dawn on July 19th. A pitched battle followed in which the gang again shot its way to freedom, wounding three cops in the getaway. But the incredible Barrow luck began to fail somewhat as Buck took a rifle ball through the temple. The gang fled to Iowa, picked a Confederate named John Sherrod, and hid out in the dense woods of Enfield Park near Dexter to give Buck an opportunity to recover. Here, some two policemen descended on the Barrow gang, and a fierce firefight developed in which the fading Buck was hit three more times while Bonnie was wounded in the right hand. With the mortally wounded Buck providing covering, Bonnie and Clyde and Sherman walked to a creek to the rear and escaped through a cornfield. Blanche elected to stay by her dying husband, thereby accepting capture and subsequent imprisonment. The fleeing trio appeared at the farm of Valley Fellers, helped themselves to food, medicines, and bandages, took over the Fellers' automobile, and lit out for Polk City, some 68 miles distant. Here they stuck up a filling station, stole the attendant's car, and doubled back 40 miles. A network of many police and airplanes, armored vehicles, motorcycles, and police cars, all in direct communication by radio, surrounded the outlaws. Yet unbelievably, they slipped through the police cordon and escaped. A few days later, Clyde, cleverly disguised as an old lady in a sunbonnet, daringly attended Buck's funeral in the French cemetery in Dallas, where Clyde would eventually be interred. The Barrow family wisely made arrangements for the undertaker at this time for that eventuality. For, wrote Bonnie, "We don't think we're too tough or desperate. We know the law always wins. We've been shot at before, and we do not ignore that death is the wages of sin." On the night of November 23rd, Sheriff Smoot Schmid of Dallas County received a tip that Bonnie and Clyde would be entering the bog via the Eagle Ford Road to visit Clyde's mother. Accordingly, an ambulance was prepared for the pair, but the daunted hoodlums shot their way through the trap and escaped, although Bonnie was wounded in the left knee and Clyde in both legs. The new year had rolled around before they were sufficiently recovered to reassume their careers, and again, they found themselves short of funds. While Clyde was a fearless gunman, he seems to have lacked the imagination for a truly successful bank robbery. He decided the time had come to liberate his accomplished former pal, Raymond Hamilton, at the time assigned to Easton Prison Farm in Houston County. The contact was developed in the person of one Hams Mullen, up for release from Easton. Clyde supplied Mullen with two .45 caliber automatic pistols, which he concealed in a tire tube beneath a small bridge near the entrance to the prison farm. Arrangements were made with the trustee to smuggle the arms into Raymond in the lockup. The next morning, Raymond smuggled their way out to the Trinity River bottom, where his crew was cutting timber. The guns were found hidden under a brush pile. The prison break was to be attempted the first morning dense fog prevailed, a common occurrence in January in that county. January 16th was such a day. The guards had hustled the convicts into the dining room around 7 a.m. and were just ordering them to work when Bonnie, seated at the wheel of a black V8 Ford with the motor running and concealed in the fog, billowing over the road that bordered the farm, honked the horn three times, the signal for action. Raymond and pal Joe Palmer leaped to the brush and seized the pistols. Palmer shot guard Olin Bozeman off his horse and mortally wounded the guard, Major Carlson, in that moment in the tall grass concealing a drainage ditch along the road. Clyde sprayed the area with machine gun fire, while Floyd signaled with his pistol for the other convicts to make a break for freedom. Henry Methven and H. Bybee followed Raymond and got across the ditch and to the getaway car, which Bonnie honked continuously to direct the escapees through the gunfire. In spite of a quick concentration of available police forces, the convicts got away clean. The break attracted national attention and centered much public wrath on police authorities. Lee Simmons, manager of the Texas prison system, despaired of recapturing Raymond and apprehending Clyde through routine police procedures. Accordingly, he created a special temporary post, the purpose of which was to get Clyde Barrow. The position carried wide and unusual police powers, with permission for the person to leave the state at any time duty required. There was one man in Texas ideally suited for the job, the fabulous Captain Frank Hamer. Hamer was a big, brilliant police officer, devoid of fear, the fastest gun in the West. Though wounded some 23 times, he had come out on top in more than 200 gunfights with outlaws unwise enough to shoot it out, and at least 53 of these lawbreakers paid with their lives. In nearly four decades of manhunting, he had never failed to get his quarry. He was presently serving as a security officer for the Houston Port Commission, but was prevailed upon to accept this new post as a public duty. He was sworn in February 10, 1934. Captain Hamer represented a living link between the Old West and the West of the 1930s. Shortly after the turn of the century, he had served as a deputy ranger and was commissioned ranger at the age of 21. Soon, people were telling authenticated stories that he could shoot birds out of the air with rifle or pistol and determine whether the wail at night was the howl of a coyote or a signal between bandits. They correctly credited him with a big part in some of the Pancho Villa bids. People in the know about his appointment to the Barrow hunt felt confident that Clyde and Bonnie were overmatched at last. But as he said, it looks like a long, long trail. Captain Hamer proceeded to Dallas, which was the principal haunt of the Barrow gang. He compared notes with the FBI office there and conferred at length with Sheriff R.A. Smoot Schmid of Dallas County, who placed at his disposal the services of Deputies Bob Alcorn and Ted Hinton. These two were personally acquainted with Clyde and Bonnie and had practically made a career of pursuing them. The trio systematically charted the gang's hideouts, the location of local relatives and friends, the travel routes commonly used by the hoodlums. Unobtrusively, Captain Hamer poked about alone in the bog. He met and cultivated a barber who was a Parker in-law. The man's shop was a gathering spot for the denizens of the bog. The chief topic of excited conversation was always the Barrow gang and their latest doings. "Ain't that Clyde a bird?" said a loafer. "Always rolling his own cigarettes out of Bull Durham and him loaded with dough." "Yeah," replied a companion. "But the way that Bonnie and Raymond Hamilton soak up whiskey, maybe old Clyde's got to cut some corners." Such casual bits of information were carefully recorded in the keen Hamer mind. One day he was getting a shave when a flashy young tough entered the shop for a hot bath, a service offered by some barbershops in those days. The lawman searched his photographic memory and located a dim image of the youth in some obscure connection with the Barrow gang. Another youth of the same ilk entered and engaged in a whispered conversation with the first one. Captain Hamer overheard Al Cafe at 9 tonight. Playing a hunch, he strolled into the cafe, a greasy spoon on the Eagle Ford Road at that hour. The place was so ill-lighted that he had to sit down and order a cup of coffee before he could case the joint. He noted what he believed to be a back dining room and sidled nonchalantly toward its door. Hamer quickly pushed it open, and drawing his .45 Colt, stepped inside. Through a back window, he caught a glimpse of a black Ford sedan throwing up a cloud of dust as it raced away into the night. The dining table supported 3 half-empty plates of food, an empty whiskey bottle, 2 drinking glasses, one of which was stained with lipstick, and an ashtray in which burned a freshly rolled Bull Durham cigarette. The chagrined manhunter holstered his pistol and strolled back into the main cafe. In a far corner, he noted the bath-seeking youth of the afternoon warily eyeing him from behind a beer bottle. "So, somebody tipped him, I'm after him," said Captain Hamer to himself. "Well, my throat's not made out of cast iron, so I don't believe I'll be going back to the bog for any more shaves." The Black Lake Country of Louisiana was next on Captain Hamer's agenda. He established liaison with police officers in the area, especially in the Nacogdoches and Bienville parishes. So many rewards were posted for Clyde and Bonnie that cataloging them was difficult. Hamer hastened to make clear his non-interest in rewards, so as to head off professional jealousy. The men pooled their information and concluded that the Barrow Gang was walking a milk route extending from Dallas through North Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Missouri to a hideout in Joplin. Then the outlaws would go through Arkansas and Louisiana to a hideout around Black Lake, and finally circle back to a hideout in Dallas. From the edge of this route, they would occasionally dart into other states, even venturing as far as Wyoming. The group was not permitting any grass to grow under its feet while Captain Hamer made book on the leaders. They made a rich haul by sticking up a Henry and Sons bank in Lancaster, outside Dallas, and escaped to Terre Haute, Indiana, at that time a haven for well-heeled outlaws. When a quarrel developed over dividing the loot, Raymond Hamilton pulled out. Thereafter, with his red-haired girl, Pretty Mary O'Dare, he operated apart from the Barrow Gang. Come Easter Sunday, April 1st, Captain Hamer, from his home in Austin, politely called the attention of Dallas police to the date, in view of the fact that among Clyde's virtues was the devotion and thoughtfulness of his mother. Perhaps he would pay her an Easter visit. For various reasons, no police investigation was made. Clyde did indeed slip into the bog and spent several hours visiting his mother. In mid-morning, he picked up Bonnie from a hideout and drove northwest several miles on U.S. Highway 114 and parked about 100 yards up a side road from Grapevine. Police records indicate the belief is that the pair waited there for Raymond Hamilton. The underworld agrees they were waiting for him as well, but for purposes of hijacking him. He had robbed the State National Bank of West Texas the day before and was now engaged in his usual game, taking over the highways with the cops. Farmer William Schaefer, busy hauling rocks to his nearby home, noted the couple nipping from a big bottle, spreading a picnic lunch about noon, and occasionally strolling arm in arm along the side road to peer up and down Highway 114. In the early afternoon, 2 young highway patrolmen, E.B. Wheeler and H.D. Murphy, came along, noted the parked black Ford sedan, wheeled their motorcycles, and entered the side road to investigate. Clyde in the back seat, enjoying a drunken nap, so only Bonnie was visible. The cops carelessly came alongside the car abreast and unprepared. Bonnie promptly upended them with blasts of buckshot from her pistol-gripped, sawed-off 20-gauge shotgun. Wheeler continued to moan on the ground, so Bonnie reached into the back seat for her Browning automatic rifle and fired a burst into his chest. He bounced just like a rubber ball, she often boasted to her pals, with something like a psychopathic glee. The outlaws roared away toward Grapevine in their usual cloud of dust. These wanton murders aroused the whole jurisdiction. A conference of federal, state, and local officers was held in Dallas to plan a to-the-death search for Clyde and Bonnie. All available forces of the FBI were ordered concentrated in the state. Chief L.G. Ferris of the Texas Highway Patrol mobilized his entire department into a pursuit army with one task: to get Bonnie and Clyde dead or alive, but preferably dead. The sheriffs and the state pledged themselves to the greatest manhunt ever undertaken in the Southwest. Public contributions in excess of $1,000 poured into the coffers of Highway Patrol, partly for rewards for the outlaws and partly for a special fund to be used in tracking them down. Governor Ferguson offered an additional $1,000 reward for the murderers. Altogether, more than one-third of the peace officers of the state participated in the manhunt, contributing to at least 10,000 days of work and traveling nearly a million miles, the total cost being fantastic. Captain Hamer doubted that this hullabaloo would accomplish the desired end, and he made available to peace officers information he had so painstakingly pieced together concerning the Barrow Gang, and helped round up their relatives and friends. Their homes were searched for the gang's arsenal, replacements, along with spare tires, stored gasoline and oil, license plates, and all the other paraphernalia needed in their interactions. Yet, sure enough, no trace was found of the phantom murderers as they sifted through masked police ranks. 5 days later, Clyde and Bonnie picked up Henry Methvin and proceeded to Commerce, Oklahoma, to stick up a bank. They got so liquored up that they got stuck in a ditch on a muddy side road outside the town, and the job was postponed until the next day. At gunpoint, they forced passing motorists to assist extricating their car. One hardy soul continued on into Commerce to report the situation to police. Constable Cal Campbell and Police Chief Percy Boyd investigated, emerging from their car with drawn pistols. The outlaws cut loose at them through their windshield, with their bars killing Campbell and injuring Boyd with a shot in the head. They kidnapped Boyd, later releasing him about midnight near Fort Scott, Kansas. Apparently, they had two principal objectives in kidnapping Boyd. Clyde wanted to tell the world through Boyd that he was not guilty of the Grapevine murders, which were putting so much heat on him. Of course, he forgot to mention Bonnie's contribution. Secondly, Bonnie wanted to inform her public that she did not smoke cigars. A photograph showing her puffing on a big cigar had recently been seized by police in a Barrow hideout and published by the press. The reaction by Bonnie's fans had been very unfavorable. Nevertheless, she did dote on cigars, according to her associates. Boyd described Methvin as remorseful concerning the murder of Campbell, but Clyde and Bonnie joshed the youth unmercifully with brutal jokes related to the killing. The gang played fox and hounds with federal, state, and local police. Even the U.S. Cavalry from Coffeyville, Kansas, joined in the hunt, all along the Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma border area. They switched automobiles at Topeka and filtered wraith-like through lawmen to a hideout in Dallas. In the next couple of weeks, they were several times positively identified by filling station operators and cafe people who notified the police. The Barrow Gang habitually fired upon the curious and asked questions neither before nor after. Somehow the cops seemed always to arrive too late for an arrest. Finally, the gang faded back into its Louisiana sanctuary. Captain Hamer stuck doggedly to the lonely, nerve-wracking pursuit. He received a reliable tip that the gang was hiding out in a wood camp near Rocky Mount Church in Bienville Parish. He forwarded this information to the proper police officers. By the time an investigation was made, the quarry had fled. Meanwhile, Raymond Hamilton, who was having a ball in New Orleans with his girlfriend, sobered up long enough to learn that he was suspected of operating with Clyde and Bonnie in their recent series of revolting murders. He dispatched a letter to his Dallas attorney, which contained proof that he could not have been involved. This letter prompted a reply from Clyde, who directed his missive to the Dallas County Assistant District Attorney. Clyde claimed that Raymond did so commit the Grapevine murders and asserted that he, Clyde, was too smart to pull such a blunder or ever be apprehended by cops. Prior to Clyde's journey into journalism, the Barrow Gang was accused of robbing a bank in Kansas on April 19th and of flubbing a bank job in Texas the next day. The seeming immunity to arrest of these thugs so outraged the man in the street that public confidence in the police ebbed to a new low. Cries for Chief Ferris's scalp grew in number. His mammoth manhunt having failed, he sent for Captain Hamer and suggested he accept a commission on the highway patrol, thereby further extending his authority and making department facilities available to him. Ferris also offered him his pick of department personnel. Captain Hamer accepted the commission and chose as an assistant Manny Gault, who was an ex-Ranger pal on many a manhunt. Homer, Ferris, Lee Simmons, Gault, Alcorn, and Hinton held a secret meeting in the Driscoll Hotel in Austin to devise plans for speeding up the Barrow hunt. Suggestions offered amounted to more of the same that had characterized the other police powwows. Captain Hamer buttonholed Simmons when the others had gone. "Lee," said Hamer, "I assume that we shall catch Bonnie and Clyde sooner or later with our present procedures, but indications point to a hell of a lot of later than sooner. The time has come to try something new." "What do you have in mind, Frank?" "As you well know, most resourceful criminals are captured through the aid of informers. Mostly women squealers, of course. But this Barrow keeps his woman with him, so we've got to look elsewhere for a fingerman." "Do you have a candidate?" "I think so. I've just completed a recheck of prison files. I came across a pitiful letter from old man Irvin Methvin of Nacogdoches Parish, Louisiana, asking what he could do to get his boy Henry out of trouble. Now, if you will approach the governor and get her consent to a pardon for Henry in exchange for his cooperating with us, I believe we can do some business with the Methvins." This suggestion was carried out. The arrangements were kept a close secret among the four persons concerned. Captain Hamer moved his headquarters to a hotel in Shreveport, Louisiana. He quickly completed arrangements with Irwin Methvin to put Clyde and Bonnie on the spot in Nacogdoches Parish. Just as the trap was about to be sprung, the FBI, with which Hamer had been operating wholeheartedly, burst into the act with screaming headlines announcing they had the Barrow Gang trapped in northeastern Louisiana and would shortly bring them to Taw. Only by a hair's breadth was the situation finally saved through another police blunder. A salesman and his red-haired woman answering the description of Clyde and Bonnie had a brush with cops in San Antonio, so the FBI shifted its efforts and headlines to that area. Thus, Hamer could go back through the tough business of reconstructing his trap, as he discovered that the Barrow Gang had not yet fled Louisiana. It was now necessary to move the Methvin family to Bienville Parish, after which Hamer returned to his home in Austin to help allay any suspicions that the gang might have developed. Police pressure on Bonnie and Clyde had become so intense, they now had to camp out in the woods, eating out of cans, one of them always awake and on guard, then racing to another hideout for a repeat. Bonnie's people were imploring her to come home and surrender to authorities. Joe Palmer, before he went to the electric chair for the murder of Guard Crawson, asserted that he was often with the Barrow Gang during this period and heard Clyde entreat Bonnie to permit him to give, provided the cops would free, to give up, provided the cops would free her. She expressed her sentiments in one of her ballads, which she regularly and bashfully mailed to the press. "The road gets dimmer and dimmer, sometimes we can hardly see. Still, it's a fight man to man, and do all we can, for we know we can never be free. On the morning of May 22nd, Irwin Methven telephoned Hamer to state that Bonnie and Clyde were due at their shack the next day to plot a holdup to the National Bank of Arcadia, Louisiana. After requesting Mrs. Hamer to contact deputies Hinton and Alcorn in Dallas and instruct them to meet him at the Shreveport Hotel, Captain Hamer picked up Manny Gault and raced there. That night, he called Mrs. Hamer to say guardedly, "The old hen's a-settin', and she'll hatch in the morning at 9:30. The four Texas lawmen proceeded to Arcadia, Louisiana, where they picked up Sheriff Jordan and a deputy. The lawmen drove out to the Jamestown sales and rode a couple of miles from the Melvin place and took up a station at the top of a small hill, hiding in cars in the woods. When morning came, they cut down numerous small pines and stuck them in the soft sand. Forming a blind on the northwest side of the road, the driver's side, for seeing anybody proceeding toward the Methven home. With the toe of his shoe, Captain Hamer drew a line across the road and calmly remarked, "Men, today is the 103rd day I have been on the trail. That trail will end on this line in a couple of hours. People will die. Maybe them, maybe us, maybe both. If anybody present feels like this is an unlucky day for him, please feel free to go back to the cars. Nobody will mind, and nobody will tell." Nobody moved. "Frank," said Manny Gault, "just one thing I'd like to know. What makes you think Bonnie and Clyde will stop at this line?" "A little bird told me," replied Hamer smilingly. At that moment, an old pickup Ford truck rattled down the lane in the direction from which the outlaw vehicle was expected. It halted at Hamer's line. Irvin Methven got out, jacked up, and removed the left rear tire and pretended to repair the tire. "I see now who your little bird is," said Gault. Methven had told Hamer that Bonnie and Clyde would be driving a light-colored Ford sedan, having unwittingly shifted from their favorite black for their last ride, bearing Arkansas license plate 15368. At 9:13 a.m., such a vehicle appeared in the piney woods around a curve about a quarter mile away. "Here they come," said Alcorn, peering through powerful field glasses. 17 minutes early," mumbled Captain Kramer as he looked at his watch. The lawmen slipped their safety catches from the automatic weapons. "Don't shoot, men, unless you hear me fire or they shoot at me," ordered Captain Hamer. "Let's give them a chance to be captured alive." Clyde recognized Old Man Methven's truck, and the oncoming car began to slow down, finally halting on Hamer's line. Clyde was neatly dressed in a summer suit, while Bonnie wore a cotton dress and a red and white scarf. She was munching a sandwich. "What's the matter? Got a flat?" he called to Methven in a voice rendered twangy by an old nose wound. Before Methven could answer, the famous fatal command, "Stick 'em up," came out in the morning air. The outlaws turned around like they were hunted animals and were and faced Hamer's automatic Barrington rifle. Bonnie slyly continued to gobble her sandwich held in her left hand while she tried to sneak her sawed shotgun into firing position with her right hand. Just as its black muzzle showed in the car window, Hamer opened fire. Other lawmen joined in, and 167 bullet holes were subsequently counted in and underneath the car. Several dozen slugs passed through the body of each hoodlum. Clyde had shifted into low gear, and his foot slipped off the clutch pedal, so the vehicle lurched forward. Alcorn came up with the bar brought along to knock out the outlaw's car motor if necessary, and he opened up with it. The bullets ricocheted in the woods, through which a logging truck occupied by the driver and two Negro loggers were passing. The death car veered to the left and ran into an embankment. Pistol in hand, he and Captain Hamer leaped to the driver's side, but Clyde was slumped over against the door and already dead, his sawed-off shotgun gripped in his hands. Bonnie, with her head nearly shot off, died over her shotgun. Hamer's first action was one of pity for her. He said he had an image of poor Wheeler Rose before he said in a nasal voice, seemed to boast, he bounced just like a rubber ball. After a bullet was discovered to have penetrated 96 pages of a blood-soaked story magazine Bonnie had in her hands, coming to rest against the advertisement, in which boldly standing out